So I think I'm going to give a talk that's maybe a little bit different than some of the others. You'll see some of that in a few moments. I'm going to be talking about our efforts over the last few years to try to understand and define the atomic structure in metallic glasses. Finding Order Within Disorder, that's a little bit of a provocative subtitle, but it's a very good descriptor, as you'll see. I want to thank one collaborator, well, two collaborators, Oleg Senkov and Peter Harrowell, who have really helped a lot with insights and discussions into some of these, some of the ideas that I'll be talking about, and a number of other colleagues as well that I've had a lot of discussions with that have sort of been helpful in moving some of these ideas forward. I was able to pull this together, so I got everybody in the picture. Didn't take too long.
You look a little bit unstable the way you see.
Well, that's because, yeah.
But that's the Photoshop effect,
I guess. Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. I thought it was good enough.
Yeah.
So I'll see if I could load this up on the site. Actually, maybe this is a long walkish. Okay, so I want to start by the caveats. I've got two strikes running against me. So this is a quote from Gordon's book. I think this was in the late 80s that he published the book. Nice book, materials-based book. So by training, I'm a metallurgist. So I tend to be more, I guess, pedantic would be the bad word. And I'm also an experimentalist by training. So I've got those two things running against me. However, I was a little surprised and actually honored to be invited here, I suppose, as a theorist. And so I'm going to see if I can pull that together and maybe be a little more lyrical and imaginative as I go through the talk. We'll see how I do when it's all said and done. Well, the particular view that I've carried with me as long as I've been working is that structure comes first and then properties flow from those structures. And when I first started working the metallic glasses 8 or 9 years ago, I remember feeling, feeling stupid, really, because I felt like I didn't know anything. Most of what I learned in graduate school required an underlying knowledge of the atomic structure and the crystalline structure. So models of strengthening, models of ductility, models for mass transport, all of those relied on an underlying crystal structure. And in metallic glasses, not only was the structure not crystalline, but at the time that we started working, no one really knew what the structure was. And so I felt very, very unsettled, like I was on quicksand all the time. Also felt very stimulated, but the basic idea was that, you know, if we really didn't know what the structure was, we didn't know very much at all, and so I was sort of motivated to try to address that from my own from my own sort of benefit. Now the approach that I take is simple, and the one thing in particular that will be different from many of the talks that we've heard is that I'm going to be giving a static view. So a lot of the talks have talked about the rheology and dynamics of systems, and I'm going to be sticking for the most part with a static view. And then three-dimensional, we've already gone from 1 to 4 dimensions, and I'll probably talk about some of those as well, but mostly I'll be working in 3 dimensions. And a couple of other things that I want to be clear right up front, because I think it distinguishes some main features of what I'm talking about versus some of the other things we've heard about. First of all, from the start, I'll be working on structures where you have at least 2 different atom sizes and up to 4, but no more than 4, and I'll show you why in a few moments. Hard spheres, for the most part, and very, very important, the structures come about from the presence of attractive potentials, and so that's a really, really important feature of the structures as well. And if you get rid of any of these sorts of constraints, you'll end up having a system that may have some common features, but ultimately will be quite a bit different. So I'm going to just skip through this. There's a cute little story that I usually tell there. This is where I simplify an elephant as a sphere. But the basic idea is that structure is important. Why don't we just go measure it? We've got lots of really, really sophisticated characterization techniques, but the bottom line is none of them give you the detail that you really, really need. With respect to diffraction techniques, you usually end up with broad statistical descriptions with 3D atom probe and so on, you don't have the required spatial resolution, and you lose a significant amount of the data. So there aren't any experimental techniques that allow us to go and measure exactly what the atomic positions are. Computations have come along a great deal in the last 10 or 20 years and give some very, very useful information. But there are two particular problems that I keep getting drawn to. One is that you eventually end up doing a system-specific simulation. A single simulation, it's a research project. You can't just go and run a few dozen off by next week. So 6 months, 9 months, a year to do a simulation. So you end up with very specific information about one system. And that's okay. However, a lot of the things that we're looking for, the insights and the structure-specific information we're looking for, are likely to come from trends and insights by looking at many systems rather than one or two carefully selected systems. And the other issue with computations is that you have an immense amount of information. So this is something that I carry around with me. The greatest strength of atomic simulations is you get the XYZ coordinates for every atom in the system. The greatest weakness is you get the XYZ coordinates for every atom in the system. And you really don't know what to do with that information unless you have some sort of organizing system look at that data. It doesn't become very useful. Okay, so spent a lot of time reading through the literature. And an awful lot of really, really good work has been done in the first 40 years or so of metallic glass research. So I just wanted to go through some of the key structural models and structural ideas. I don't have to spend much time with this. This is the continuous network model from Zachariasen. I think most of you are probably quite familiar with that. Key fundamental issues or points are that you have a representative structural element. That's these silicon-centered tetrahedra, SiO4 tetrahedron. Those tetrahedron are linked by sharing common vertices, just like you would have in the quartz structure. But the only real distinction there, however, is that in the quartz structure, you have a very specific silicon-oxygen-silicon bond angle, and in metallic glasses, you have some standard deviation. It's not a big standard deviation. It's only a few degrees deviation, but that's enough to break the symmetry and to produce an amorphous structure. So that's the basic idea. You can then have other network formers and network modifiers that may contribute to the structure in different ways. I won't talk about that now. But there are a couple of important distinctions between metallic glasses and the silicate glasses that might lead you to think that the structure might not be exactly the same. So first of all, in metallic systems, the bonding is mostly non-directional. Spherical potentials don't do that bad of a job. You do, of course, get some covalent character, bond hybridization, and so on. But best estimates suggest that the majority of the bonding is of metallic character. Also, in the oxide glasses, some of the structural features come about from conservation of charge. That's not a constraint in metals. The atoms are usually neutral. And then the final thing is that in oxide glasses, borosilicate glasses, and so on, you have a large difference in atomic sizes. So for example, if you look at the borate glasses, the oxygen ion has a radius that's about 7 or 8 times larger than the boron ion. So large differences in atomic radii. In metallic glasses, the difference in atomic size is quite a bit smaller. So we look at radius ratios. I'll use this uppercase R to denote the radius of the solute divided by the radius of the solvent. Typically, it's 1 plus or minus 0.4, so you don't have the same sort of variability that you do in some of the other glasses.
What did you mean by conservation of charge is not a constraint?
So if you have, in the silicate glasses, you have charged ions, and you can't arbitrarily change compositions without paying attention to the charge. You have to enforce local and global charge neutrality. And you don't have to do that with the metals.
Yeah, the silicons apparently with 3 neighbors, not 4?
It depends. It depends on the glass. Typically the silicon has 4 oxygen neighbors, but
your drawings did all 3.
Well, okay, yeah, so I made a big point of saying I'm going to speak in 3 dimensions, but that was a 2-dimensional image, wasn't it? Those pictures actually I took directly out of Zachariasen's paper. So that's the way that he showed it. This is a two-dimensional representation, but he was trying to illustrate that that was a tetrahedron.
There is a
yes. There's another dimension coming at you.
A trivial question: is the word continuous actually significant? What's it mean in this context?
I'm not sure.
It's just that picture. That's all we use.
Yeah. I use continuous because that was his word.
No, it was, but yeah. I just wondered what he meant.
I'm sorry.
Does it mean continuous versus as opposed to on a lattice?
I'm not sure.
I guess the idea was.
It doesn't matter. It's still not continuous. It doesn't have anything to do.
Yeah.
There was variability on angles.
All right.
Yeah.
You could have a random lattice but fixed bond angles.
Yep. Okay.
This is random in terms of having ranges for angles and distance.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank Don for giving a very nice talk on some of Bernal's concepts. I can skip over the next few charts a little bit more quickly, but one of the first models for metallic glasses, and probably even still the most widely used, is the dense random packing model. It's a little funny because Bernal never intended it for that, but I think it's just a historical quirk that Bernal first started to publish this work in the late 1950s, and it was 1960 when the first metallic glass was discovered, and so the metallic glass community was anxious for some model to use, and there was this new model that was widely being discussed, and so they sort of latched onto that, even though that wasn't Bernal's intent. So, you know, we can describe in a statistical sort of sense what the dense random packing model is. So these are what Bernal proposed as his representative structural elements. He called them holes based on the atomic configuration around the different interstices that were formed in the structure. And they did a lot of modeling to show which of these were most common. Of course, it was these two and what their statistical distribution was and so on. So that was the main idea. The issue was nobody ever made an elemental metallic glass. It was always an alloy with at least two different elements or more. And so you have to be able to reconcile Bernal's concept with that idea. And an obvious one that was, I think it was in the late 1960s, proposed by Polk, was that, we'll take the second elements, which were almost always quite a bit smaller. The most common glasses studied in the first 10 years or so included metal-metalloid glasses, and the metalloid elements were quite a bit smaller than the metals. Radius ratio was about 0.7 or so. And so Polk proposed that these metalloids fill in the Bernal holes, and that's what forms the glass structure. And so proposed this model, and within about a year or two, it was accepted within the community that was probably not a good approach. Basic idea shown here, these are the size and distribution of the Bernal holes from two different models, Finney and Bennett. Not surprisingly, you see the largest number of holes are around the tetrahedral interstices, so a large number around the octahedral interstices. But it's been shown time and time again that there are no large holes, no vacancies, if you want to think of it like that, in the metallic glass structure. And so when you get to holes that have a radius about 60% of that of the host atom, you get to a negligible amount of interstices. However, as I mentioned, the metal-metalloid glasses have a radius ratio that is 0.6 or 0.7 or higher. And the concentration of the metalloid elements was typically around 20%. And so you need a population of holes that's up here off the chart, and it's just not compatible with the availability of holes in the dense random packing model. So a lot of people had shown quite convincingly not long after this idea that probably wasn't a good idea to take forward. In the late 70s and in through the middle 80s, there was an idea that was first proposed by Philip Gaskell, and had a number of co-workers, what he calls the stereochemically defined model, taking one of the key initial insights from Zachariasen and applying it to metals. And that key insight, Zachariasen's insight, was that, metallic glasses, okay, they're metastable, but they're not that much less stable than the crystal. And if that can only occur if the total energy of the amorphous system is not a whole lot different than the total energy of the crystalline system. And Zachariasen further rationalized that most of the internal energy comes from the nearest neighbor atomic bonding, and so the nearest neighbor environment in the amorphous structure, he felt, should be the same as the nearest neighbor environment in the competing crystal. And so that's why you get these SiO4 tetrahedron.
So was that statement about oxide glasses or metallic glasses?
Oxide glasses. Oxide glasses. And so Gaskell took exactly that idea and applied it to metallic glasses.
So, I mean, is that as obvious here? Because that's the whole problem of making them, isn't it? The free energy frequency is rather large.
I mean, maybe you know that. I don't know that. There are several distinctions, right? There's the difference in total energy. There are kinetic issues. And then there are kinetic pathways that have different activation barriers. So, I mean, again, maybe people in the audience know this. I don't know for sure that the internal energy of the amorphous structure in metals is a whole lot higher than the internal energy of the competing crystals.
And you refer to the book by Miedema, but I think that he went through a whole set of metals to show under what conditions actually they would switch. Really, HCP, I think that typically you would have two competing crystal structures, BCC and HCP, and where the two were competing, basically, this is where the metal, the glasses typically were in their best position, and that supports your energy argument that there's really not a lot of energy difference.
Yeah, actually, so we've done some recent work as well that shows that the best glasses are where the driving force for the competing crystals is the lowest.
No, that's clearly, so that's the least difference between the crystal and the metallic glass.
Yeah.
And certainly the principle that we use to find good compositions, etc.
But the
reason that you have to sort of work hard is because that even that least difference is still pretty large.
Yeah. I mean, it could be, I don't know. If anyone knows of work where people have actually quantified the energy difference, I'd be interested in seeing that.
Measure excess
energies. Okay, and is the number large?
Yeah, I mean it's.
And this is all qualitative, anyways, right? So how large is large? But
yeah, I mean, for if you take a binary composition, I don't remember the numbers, but in terms of, you know, using a classical nucleation expression to figure out how big your nucleation rate is, they're still very large.
But doesn't that relate more to the energy barrier between the initial and final?
Yeah.
Which doesn't tell you what the difference between the two states is.
No, the energy barrier is given by, is inversely proportional to how much the difference between the crystal and the melt free energies.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of missing that, but I mean, so if you have, you can also have, and so the energy barrier, I guess I'm not seeing a direct relationship between the difference between beginning and ending state.
So can I ask something, Sri? Because very often the competition is between a metallic glass at exactly the same composition and a two-phase system of crystals. So then the kinetics I think the two statements are not necessarily in contradiction. That at the fixed composition, there may be a very small energy difference, but actually if metastable is respected to diminishing, and then you can go to a presumably crystal structure that have a much lower energy. But if given the time.
Yeah, well, so, okay, maybe as I understand it, so like you said, I mean, if you're looking at the bond, you know, a composition regime where, let's say, two different crystals are, you know, they're close in their stability, then the free energy difference from the liquid to either one of them is roughly the same, right?
Yeah.
And if you look at that number, that gives you, you know, being blind to sort of which crystal structure you would form, that's, you can sort of work out a nucleation barrier from that. And that will be pretty small, right? I don't,
In fact, I've sort of asked people this question. I don't know if people have paid a lot of attention to the fact that typically the crystal that you would want to form will arise as a result of phase separation, and what are the kinetic factors involved.
But even if it's not phase separation, as Don said, you usually form metallic glass in the middle of two competing crystals. And to form the equilibrium structure, you need significant atomic redistribution. And so there is a significant kinetic component as well.
No, I understand there is, but I haven't seen or heard.
Well, and the other
discussion of that.
And the other thing with respect to the comment that you made, which was very well enunciated, comparing a liquid to two different crystals, the system that we have here is much farther from equilibrium, and it might be a little dangerous to take those ideas where you have small deviations from equilibrium and try to extrapolate that to systems where you're far from equilibrium.
If these ideas are correct, then the best place to look for metallic glass would be a solid critical point in three dimensions. And Don had worked on a solid critical point in two dimensions where
there are metals that have a solid, like with a cerium, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't know what I made people.
Yeah, cerium is a common element in metallic glasses. Cerium-based glasses. Well, so let me go on because this was basically just an insight that Gaskell had, and it turned out to be largely correct in terms of the local, maybe not the thinking, but the final point, and that is that the local atomic structure in metallic glasses is often found to be quite similar to the local atomic structure in the competing crystal. And so in the metalloids, if you look at iron 3 boron, nickel 3 boron, palladium 3 silicon, you end up with this, what's called a cap trigonal prism. You have the solute atom here, and it's surrounded by 9 solvent atoms. So you have basically a simple trigonal prism. And then each one of the three rectangular faces is capped by an atom. So you have coordination number of 9. This is what Gaskell proposed to be the local coordination shell in the metallic glass, consistent with diffraction data, which showed that each metalloid element typically had 9, 8.5 to 9.5 solvent elements. And then much later, the Osaka group had done some very, very nice high resolution electron microscopy coupled with atomistic simulations and showed that this was in palladium silicon. In fact, you do have these arrangements in the metallic glass structure. So even if some of his thought process might not have been actually correct, the end result is that you have these local atomic structures that are similar to the crystals seems to be.
So one question about this. This is just about structure now. People seem to make a distinction between something that's a glass and something that's an amorphous solid. And I've always been puzzled about what the distinction is, and practically speaking, the distinction seems to be that you don't make the amorphous solids that you talk about through a glass transition. Okay, you do something else, like vapor deposition or something. And so I asked. So this came up in talking to Inouye, because he also used this terminology. And his answer to the question of what the difference is that amorphous solids are those where the local structure in the glass, or in the amorphous solid, is very close to the crystal, whereas in a glass former, the local structure in the liquid is rather different from that of the crystal.
Okay.
So this I haven't had time to really go through and
so I think I can make things a little easy. For the purpose of my talk, I'm not going to distinguish between a glass system and an amorphous system. There are, of course, some subtle potential distinctions. I'm not going to draw them in this talk. It's not important for the basic concept that I'd like to, but it would be a great discussion over another couple bottles of wine. Okay. Is there another? No? Okay. Okay, so this was Gaskell's contribution, and this doesn't really give you a model, because to have a model, you now also have to describe how those representative structural elements organize in space. And his thought was that in the oxide glasses, you share common vertices. which is an insight taken from the competing crystals, due to the observation that metallic glasses had densities very close to the crystalline competing crystals, Gaskell argued that instead of sharing common vertices, you would share common edges or common faces. And so he tried after that to build models where he packed these clusters together, physical models using, you know, hard spheres sort of like this. I think he used styrofoam balls. And he never got beyond, you know, a couple dozen of these units before he just sort of gave up. There was too much packing frustration and he wasn't able to fill space in any sort of convincing way. They did quite a bit of work after that, looking at simple chemical twinning and so on, but the bottom line was that by the mid-80s, this idea, although it did show some attractive agreement with some aspects to experiment, didn't seem to be a very compelling model. And in my nomenclature, this was probably the last attempt at an atomic model for metallic glasses for a long, long time until about 5 or 6 years ago when we sort of cast our towel in the ring. There were lots and lots of things after that that are what I would call structural concepts, where it defined some sort of organizing principle or some feature, but it you could never really build a model from it. And again, there are lots and lots of them. This is one that's often quoted, the confusion principle. So I just use this as a proxy for the large field of these other structural concepts. The idea was basically that the more different types of atoms, different sizes that you put in, the more confused the structure becomes and it doesn't know what to do, and so it just ends up with a glass structure. To my knowledge, there's only been one attempt to look at that through a controlled set of experiments, and it didn't support this idea. And it's been my corollary that the atoms aren't confused at all. They know exactly what they were doing, but we're the ones that are confused. Okay, so again, being an experimentalist, our approach then was to try to draw some insight from the vast amount of experimental data that had been collected over the years on metallic glasses. A lot of this information, actually, if you think about it carefully, has structural implications. And so just wanted to give kind of a list of...
Just go back to the previous slide for one moment. Because you'd think that the first effect of mixing many components is that you go get a very low deep eutectic, and that, I mean, that's the prerequisite to come into a super good liquid at all. But that probably is more important than everything you say about what atoms know or don't know.
There are some other funny aspects to that, though, as well. You're probably familiar with the Stockdale puzzles. It was in the 1930s or so. Stockdale noticed that when you look at eutectic compositions in binary metal alloys, they almost always occurred at a simple ratio of low integer numbers, 2 to 3, 3 to 5, 3 to 4. And what's that? Yes, crystals, from the liquid to the crystal. So you have a eutectic point, and the composition of that eutectic point with two competing crystals, that composition was usually a simple ratio of low integer numbers. And he never was able to explain that in the 30s, and then Hume Rothery picked that up during his work, tried to explain it, couldn't explain it as well. So it's not just what you said, but there are these other constraints as well. And as I'll show you, some of the ideas that we'll be developing here actually have been used to sort of resolve this Stockdale mystery.
Well, again, I think for the kinetics, it does have, the eutectic has very clear implications. Yeah. I think that's part of the story.
Yes, yep. Okay, so these are just sort of a summary of experimental observations that have been collected in metallic glasses up through the year 2000. And I'll just mention a few of them. Randomness, of course, is the dominant and the defining feature. Efficient atomic packing is required over all length scales. In terms of global length scales, people have shown very convincingly that the best glasses in a given binary system occur at the compositions that have the lowest molar volume. People have also measured, I'll show here, the density change upon crystallization. Normally, if you take a pure element and go from the liquid to the solid, you get a volume change of between 4 and 12%. The best metallic glasses, the volume change is less than 0.5%. And so that suggests that somehow these structures globally must be packed in a rather efficient configuration. In terms of the local efficient packing, I'm not going to talk much about that now, but we had done some work that showed that the local atomic packing was also very, very efficient. So this we knew. Strong short range ordering, not surprising. But also in 1982, I think Lamparter and Steeb did a very nice diffraction study where they separated the three different partial pair distribution functions, and they found significant medium range order. Totally surprised the community, and for 20 years no one was ever really able to explain the basis for that medium range order. But even after their first study in 1982, many other people looked at other glass systems as well, and it was found to be in every case where people looked, they always found significant medium range order.
Can you say a bit more?
I'll say a lot more. You mean
what was the medium range order?
Yeah, that's an important part that I'll show you, so I'll say a lot more about that. And so these other things as well. So it was our view that there's a lot of structure-specific information here, and if you think about it carefully, you might be able to draw some insights from it. And it was our goal to try to build a structural model that would have consistency with a lot of these experimental observations. If you just sort of take a scorecard on where things were around the year 2000, these are the different structural models or structural concepts that were on the table at the time. These are the different experimental observations that I've mentioned. And you'll see, largely, none of the models did a very good job in explaining all the experimental observations. This stereochemically defined model probably did the best, but still had some significant issues. I want to point out that no one was able to explain the basis of the medium range order, nor show quantitative agreement with the observed medium range order. And this is going to be a key feature that we'll focus on in our model development as well. So I'll change some famous quotes only in a small way in some of these. So gentlemen, we've run out of models, now we must think. And I'm going to base some of our ideas on insights that we've drawn from previous researchers in the literature. The main thing I'm going to focus on is efficient filling of space. And so I just have a couple of charts that show that this is a really neat topic. It's hundreds of years old. There's a lot of fun in there. If anyone is interested, I could give you some more citations. I won't spend much time on this. Again, Don covered this very nicely yesterday. The only point that I do want to make is that solving a putative solution for Kepler's conjecture represents the longest unsolved problem in discrete geometry. It took almost 400 years to solve the very simple problem, and that is, how do you most efficiently pack equal size spheres? The problem we're trying to solve is much more complicated. Now we have systems of unequal spheres, and we want to know what is the most efficient way to fill space with unequal spheres. And we've spent some time, we convened a meeting a few years ago with a number of mathematicians, and the conclusion we got from that meeting was that we don't even know how to pose the question, let alone how to start to solve the problem. It's a very, very complicated problem. And so rather than trying to take a brute force approach with a rigorous mathematic solution, you'll see the approach we take is maybe a little bit more pictorial. So we'll see. So here are some of the insights that I had drawn from reading through the literature. Some rather provocative comments, actually. I'll just read a few of them. This is from Gaskell. This suggests correlated rather than random arrangements of local structural units. This is one of my favorites. We can no longer think in the seductive simplicity of randomness alone. What's that?
It's quite lyrical.
It is, yeah. I love this fellow's writing. He's in my opinion, I like this fellow. He's done a lot of really good work. I spent some time in Cambridge about 4 years ago and had a chance to talk with him for a few hours. Very nice fellow. Very talented. Okay, the amorphous state is not a disordered state, but rather a well-organized arrangement of atoms. There may be an underlying ordering or structure-forming principle, and simple geometry will prove to be the main criterion. That's from Robert Kahn. So a lot of really good work had been done by some early researchers, and we used ideas like those as sort of guiding ideas and insights and principles. So what I'm going to do now, I'll start to talk about the thoughts that we've sort of applied in this area, and I'll break it down into discussions about how you might define the local structure, and then how you might define the extended structure, and I'll end up with a structural model, and then I'll go through some validation on that as well. So the structure-forming principle that we focus on is the efficient filling of space. By the way, that's the only thing you have to enforce to get the FCC structure, just efficient filling of space. And the main criteria we're going to be focusing on is the relative size of atoms initially. So I'm going to start with just a simple two-dimensional pictogram. I think that everybody is probably very familiar with this, but it's just a good place to make sure we're all at the same starting point. If we have, I'll call this blue circle, or think of, you can also think of it as a sphere in a moment. I'll call this the solute. These are the solvents. And if you look at the relative size and look at the local packing arrangements, we would say that this is, without defining at this moment, I'll say that this is an efficiently packed configuration. There are no gaps between the atoms in the first coordination shell. If we keep the size of these circles the same, for simplicity, I'll say this has a unit radius, and increase the size of this. Coordination number stays the same, but now you get gaps, and so it qualitatively would say this is slightly less efficiently packed. And so you can see what happens. You keep increasing the radius ratio until you can increase the coordination number, and again you get to an efficiently packed configuration, and you just sort of cycle through. Okay. So what you can do is you can actually define what I'll call a theoretical coordination number. I call it theoretical because it's a real number, and it's just given by very simple equation. Takeshi Yagami co-worker actually published this many, many years ago. And so you can define what that theoretical coordination number is. Of course, in a physical system, you are restricted to an actual coordination number, which will be the integer part of this. So if you truncate this, then you get the actual coordination number.
The question is, this is now, looking at the geometry in the immediate vicinity of one.
Yeah, one circle and its first coordination shell.
Could I imagine that when the size looks frustrated at this level, maybe there is sort of a larger scale organization which will be efficient?
I'm not sure I understand your...
No, so looking at one blue disk and five.
Yeah.
But maybe I should look at sort of two of the blue and 10 of the red and see what is the best packing method.
Yeah, so at this point we're just talking about one circle and its first neighbor environment. So we're not dealing with that yet, but we'll get there in a minute. Because once we identify what these representative structural elements are and what guides their formation, then we'll go to talk about how they pack to fill space. And by the way, it's an interesting observation that in two dimensions there is no packing frustration. That comes out in three dimensions. Okay, so anyway, so this is the theoretical coordination number, and I define then the packing efficiency as the real coordination number, which is just the truncation of that divided by that. And then if you go ahead and plot that up, looks something like this. So this black line is the continuous function, theoretical coordination number. These blue lines are the actual values, so over a range of radius ratios it's constant. And then you get to some radius ratio where you increase the coordination number by one. So that's where this black line crosses an integer number here. And then you can go read what that radius ratio is. And so the packing efficiency goes from one at one of these radius ratios where you just fill the first shell, and then it progressively decreases until you get to the next radius ratio where you increase the coordination number by one. Packing efficiency goes up again. So the packing efficiency sort of ratchets like this. And you can see here these are like the two-dimensional pictograms of efficient filling of the first coordination shell with coordination number of 4, 5, 6, 7, and in between you'll get, something sort of like that. So that's sort of the basic idea. And our contribution then was to take that simple idea and do exactly the same thing, but now to do it in three dimensions. And now packing frustration becomes an important issue, but we're going to sort of sweep it under the rug for a moment. But what we did then is we tried to come up with a way to determine how many spheres of radius 1, unit radius, you could pack around another sphere with a radius different than that. And so the way that we chose to approach the problem is actually not a whole lot different from what other people had tried to do as well, is we asked ourselves the question, if we take this small atom and then we put a unit-sized sphere on top of it, how much of the surface area on this central sphere is occupied by this? So what most people had done is they just take the, this solid steric angle, and they say that's how much area is associated with it, and then they would take the total area, surface area of this sphere, and divide it by this number, and you would get some idea of how many atoms you could pack in the first on the first coordination shell. Didn't show real good agreement with a lot of observations, and there was a very simple issue with that particular approach, and that is when you pack atoms in the first shell, you don't just take up the amount of area here, but you also have these spaces here. Think of it if you put spheres on a flat table, you have these little gaps in between, so you have to account for that as well.
So this is like basically Voronoi decomposition.
Exactly, on a curved surface. That's exactly what it is. So what we did is we take a line between the center of this sphere and a line between the center of that sphere, have a perpendicular bisecting plane, and then where that intersects the surface of this thing here, you get a great circle, and another great circle, and another great circle, and so we just calculate the area inside here. Now, to do that, you have to know how many other unit spheres touch both the sphere that you're interested in and this sphere here, and that's an explicit function of the relative size. So with a radius ratio here, which is, let's say it's around 0.3, you can have only three others. If the radius ratio is greater than 0.414, now you can have four others. If the radius ratio is greater than 0.902, you can have five others, and that's it. You can never get more than five on a curved surface. If you have an entirely flat surface, this, of course, will go to six. But for curved surfaces, five is the largest. So so then we just... Okay, so let's imagine we take equal-sized spheres and we put them on the floor. And we put one here, we can get six others around it. Okay? As soon as we make the floor just a little bit curved, we can no longer get six around that center one. And have it still touch that curved surface.
So the condition is all of them are touching.
Yeah. So the condition is that this sphere here touches this sphere here, and that these touch both of them. It's like a common neighbor analysis. So as soon as you have curvature, you can't get six any longer. Yeah, it's on another view graph, but we can talk more about that later if you'd like. So we end up with this equation for the theoretical coordination number now in three dimensions. It's an explicit function of the radius ratio and of this term n, which I show here, which itself is an explicit function of the radius ratio. So this is can be solved just by knowing the radius ratio, and you get a result very much like I showed in two dimensions. So we get this function here. We get a discontinuity as you go from 4 to 5. If we carried this farther down, there'd be another discontinuity where you go from 3 to 4. Everything's quite well behaved. You get packing efficiencies that ratchet like they did before. And if you pull off the radius ratio where this function is exactly an integer, then you get these preferred radius ratios where you get efficient packing in the first shell. So for example, if the radius ratio is 0.710, you can, we would predict you can just get 9 unit spheres in the first shell. Radius ratio 0.799, you can just get 10, and so on. So this is just a simple mathematical approach, and the idea then is that if the efficient filling of space in the first coordination shell is important in the formation of metallic glasses, then you might see some preference for metallic glasses that have these radius ratios and not others. So what we did is we looked at lots and lots of metallic glasses. We've just recently finished an assessment of binary metallic glasses where we, it's always a bold claim that's certain to be wrong, but we tried to find every binary glass produced by Liquid Metal Quench that had been published. We found 179 different systems. And for each one of those, we get a radius ratio, and then we did a histogram. And we also did that for complex glasses as well, and so this is...
Can I just ask you that the graph, where the red arrows were, so where the NT is integer, you should...
This one?
Obvious that you can realize all those packings?
No.
You just did a sort of volume...
Yeah, so this, it's not obvious. And let's see, I'll show a few charts just a couple moments later. That actually, the mathematics community has latched onto this problem. It started in 1932. It's called the Thomas problem. It's named after a German biologist who was looking at the distribution of pores on the surface of a pollen grain. And he found that they were distributed in a way that sort of maximized their separation from one another. And so the mathematics community posed the problem by saying you have a sphere of some radius, and then the question is, how many spheres of unit radius can you pack on there? And so they actually have rigorous mathematical solutions for coordination numbers from 2 to 12, and for 24, and then putative solutions for everything up to. And so those clusters are very well known, and they largely match most of these numbers, but they don't always. And the reason they don't is based on, I think, what Don was talking about a little bit yesterday, and that is that the mathematics community works with hard spheres, and the atoms, although we're idealizing them as hard spheres, they're not really hard spheres, but they do have some ability to squish a little bit. And I've built lots and lots of clusters like this, and it becomes clear to you that if you could just squeeze them just a little bit, then you could get some slightly better.
Can I ask something directly related to the last point, and that's, everybody always talks about the radius of atoms, but that's of course a fiction of our imagination. And it's when you read Pauling, he's very careful about that. He says, well, it is amazing, it effectively, it looks as if you can get the distance of closest approach between two atoms by treating them as particles with their individual radius. But I can imagine that in different metallic glasses, the different metals have effectively, different
radii. Yeah, so we've spent a lot of time thinking about that. There's actually an awful lot of data available. If you go to the crystallographic handbooks, you can find the interatomic distances between as many different atom pairs as you choose to look at. And what we find is that for ionic bonding, it's a huge effect. For strongly covalent bonding, it's a huge effect. For metallic bonding, it's an important effect, but it's not as big as you might think. The biggest difference in atomic radii in metallic elements is typically no more than 15%, and it's usually less than 7%, which is actually within the stated error precision of what people give as the atomic radii anyways. People usually say that the precision is usually plus or minus 5 picometers. So that's one point. The second point is that in all of our work here, we're dealing with radius ratios, and so that sort of sweeps that potential issue under the rug a little bit. Yes. Yeah. Well, and they do, by the way. So when I say that the radii change with if you have metallic systems with a small amount of covalent bonding, both radii shrink. Well, we don't know that, but we know that the separation between them shrink, and so we've done quite a bit of analysis, moving the numbers around different ways. And you know, we side with Pauling that it's amazing that things seem to work that well, because you know, at a very basic level, they're not hard, they're not spheres, and they should, and their radii should depend on who their neighbors are.
The pair distance look like they're additive?
Yes, largely. If you look at, if you take the elements and then look at the crystal structures, they're not additive. And again, they usually decrease by, 5 to 15%.
Within the given structure, if you have different pairs, and you decompose them into putative radii, do they come out to be additive?
Mostly. It's a good question, because it's not a simple question. Even if you take a pure element, you find that nearest neighbors have variable separations. So without a doubt, this is a simplification of convenience that seems to have some. I'm not going to argue that it's right, but it gives some practical guidance.
So within the same composition,
would you have that kind of variability in the radius that you might estimate?
I'm sorry, in the same composition?
Yeah, in the same, yeah, in different local environments, for example.
That's what you just said.
Yeah, I think the answer is yes, but I'm not quite exactly. If I have a structure with
the same element, you have different local environments and different atomic radii, right?
Yeah.
At different points in a complicated lattice.
Or even in this, if you take, we use the handbook, crystallographic handbook by Doms and Villers and Van Vugt. And so, for example, if you look at the structure of a given, well, let's pick an element, for example. A lot of elements have just one structural environment. But even with just one structural environment, you have different atom separations.
In different directions.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the answer to the question you were asking is yes. So these are the results from this statistical analysis of radius ratios in metallic glasses. This is for the binary metallic glass systems. There were, again, 179 different systems. So we took the solute radius divided by the solvent radius and then just put them in bins. And we find that rather than sort of a broad featureless distribution, we get rather specific radius ratios preferred. And these vertical lines are the radius ratios that we predicted from this simple model that I just showed you. So we see, in fact, that there is a very strong preference for the radius ratios that we had predicted, which is... We've also done this for complex glasses, so vitriloid glasses, plating-based glasses, magnesium-based glasses. And in each one of the complex glasses, we take each of the solute, the radius for each of the solutes and divide it by the radius of the solvent. So for example, a glass with three elements, we would get two radius ratios. A glass with four elements, we would get three and so on. And again, we get a histogram that looks something like this. And again, we see strong preference for the radius ratios that we predict to give efficient local atomic packing.
What are the gaps?
Not all the predicted ratios are
this. I was going to talk about this near the end, but yeah, we don't know. So, for example, I could argue that the reason we don't get many here or here is just because there aren't that many element pairs that have those radius ratios at the extremes. And these two right here, you could understand based on simple internal strain arguments. Takeshi has published work like this for a long time, and Inoue's insight that the radius ratio has to be plus or minus 12%. It's the same thing. So you might expect that these radius ratios wouldn't be preferred just because the size difference is too small and you don't get large internal strains. But why is this one missing? Why is this one missing? We don't know. It was surprising to us.
So there
are some that are clearly preferred, and I'm going to show you a topological argument near the end of the talk why we think that might be true.
Maybe I misunderstand, but is the gap in the middle then like the complement of the Hume-Rothery rule?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, the inverse Hume-Rothery rule.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. So these give extended solid solutions, but they aren't good glass formers. Right.
Which isn't something. No. I'm sorry, the Hume-Rothery rule is 12%.
10%, actually.
Yeah.
This is for extended solid solutions. That was Hume-Rothery had these four rules: electronegativity, size difference, crystal structure, and.
That's also where the in a way thumb rule comes from, right?
Actually not. If you read through the literature, there were a lot of people who had proposed size differences in metallic glasses before Inoue made his famous statement in 1991. Davis had done a lot of work. The names are escaping me now. But there were, at least three other people in the 60s and 70s had proposed plus or minus 10%, plus or minus 12%.
I don't mean who came up with it, but in terms of making metallic glasses with that as a guiding principle. I thought that came from the Hume-Rothery rule.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Okay, so here we are. We've got some preferred radius ratios. Each of those radius ratios carries with it a specific coordination number. It's a closed problem. You can actually build these clusters now. And again, I'll mention that the mathematics community, I mean, it's a huge literature on this. There are literally books and books and books written. Fejes Toth, the Hungarian mathematician, is probably the best known in that area, but lots and lots of work. And so they've identified what these most efficiently packed clusters are from a mathematical perspective. And so these are the sorts of things that you might imagine. I show a couple of them for 10. This is an icosahedron for 12. This is a cube octahedron. So these are both old friends in the metallurgical community. Cap trigonal prism, Archimedean antiprism, tetrahedron, octahedron. So you know some of these. And what we would say then, we would propose that these are candidate local representative structural elements in the formation of metallic glasses. And this, by the way, is really no different than what Gaskell proposed. The only thing is that we've generalized it beyond a coordination number of 9. So it's really exactly that same idea.
And these structures, they would also give you the correlation between the solute, the ratio, the radius ratio, and the composition, wouldn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. And so, Dan, back to your question about atomic sizes. It's a real important issue, and we have made this simplifying assumption. And I just used this chart just to remind me to talk about that. So we've already talked about that. Okay, so that's the local structure. So now let's go to the extended structure. And what I'm going to propose is that these
So you talk about filling the space with these structures, but you also require that these structures can't fill space in an orderly way, because otherwise you'll make some complicated periodic structure instead.
So let me go through the next few charts, and you can tell me if it's complicated or not. Just starting very generally, I'm going to argue that they do organize in some way. And it could be a random way. I mean, random isn't, I mean, you can distinguish random from ordered from disordered. So I mean, it's not like random is, I mean, it's its own little pocket as well. So we're just going to argue that these clusters organize in some way. But before I go there, I just want to talk in very a broad sort of way about why we would expect them to organize at all. And I'm going to just, this is sort of a hand-waving chart, just want to talk about how the atoms respond to decreasing temperature. And again, this is just a very qualitative sort of argument. And I want you to not pay too much attention to the temperature scale. The main point that I want to make is that the first couple of states that I'm talking about are in the liquid state. It's not in the supercooled liquid state. So I'm going to define a bond energy E, and I'm going to specify that as the energy of the bond between on-like atoms. And I'm further going to say that that's the most stable of the three types of bonds that would exist in this binary system. So the energy of an AA bond and the energy of a BB bond are less stable than the energy of an AB bond. And this is exactly what you would expect for glass-forming systems and for intermetallic compounds. This has a negative deviation from an ideal regular solution and so on. So we start at some very high temperature where the thermal energy is larger than the energy of this bond. And so, of course, you have lots and lots of bonds, but we simply say that they don't persist in time. So you have this stochastic structure of fluid, a liquid, where the bonds are continually being made and broken. As you cool down the temperature, you'll eventually get to some temperature where the thermal energy is of the same magnitude as the bond energy. And so now you have AB bonds like you did before, but the AB bonds begin to persist in time. And when that happens, you can start to say now that you have these structural units, a cluster. You can think of it like that. And so you're still making and breaking lots of bonds. And for example, you know, the bond here, you might break that. And so these clusters can move around. But you start to form these clusters as identifiable structural elements. A couple of things that you would expect. You would expect to see the emergence of short-range order, and you would also expect to see some kinetic effect, and both of those qualitatively, in terms of the short-range order, that's been observed experimentally using X-ray diffraction of liquids. You can see that short-range order begins to occur and persist for as much as 100 or 200 degrees Celsius above the liquidus temperature. And in terms of a qualitative argument, where you have melting point suppression like at a eutectic, the liquid becomes more viscous, and that's what you would expect when you start to have larger structural elements. So that's sort of a qualitative consistency. You continue to cool down further, and so these bonds not only persist, but they begin to percolate. You start to form fragments of a topologically disordered network, and eventually you get to some temperature where you percolate and form an extended network. So again, this is totally qualitative, totally subjective, but it's not unreasonable to expect that these structural elements may want to organize. And there are a lot of different ways that you could state that. I've chosen to state here that it's motivated by solute-solute avoidance. There are a lot of other ways you can state it, but it also, by the way, is directly, it's a direct consequence of having different magnitudes of AB versus AA and BB bonds. So I just use this just to make myself feel comfortable that, okay, maybe these clusters would organize in some way, although we haven't specified what that is yet. So now, Mike, to your question, here's what we propose is exactly how they organize. If we defocus our eyes, we can think of these solute-centered, these efficiently packed clusters as a dense agglomeration of matter and space. We can think of that as sphere-like, and of course it's not. It's knobby and it's got all these little dents and everything. But if we think of it as a sphere-like agglomeration and you ask what's the most efficient way to fill space, with a given amount of mass, then we might imagine that these sphere-like clusters organize on something like an FCC sort of arrangement. And I'm going to talk quite a bit about this now, pros and cons. We've looked at lots and lots of different possibilities, not only crystalline arrangements, but also non-crystalline arrangements of clusters, icosahedral, random, and so on. And the FCC cluster packing gives intuitively the best agreement with efficient packing, but there's also very specific quantitative agreement with the measured medium range order, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So this is rule number one. And there are some very, very important consequences that come from this that start to give some new insight. So first of all,
But this would also argue that there should be specific compositions that are important or significant.
Maybe. That was our initial thought, and we still think that's true, and the answer is yes. And I'll show you some of that specifically. I'll show you what those compositions are, how they change with radius ratio, and so on.
Clusters already exist in the gas phase.
Somewhere in the liquid phase, we would say they form. You can heat a liquid high enough where they don't exist. But somewhere in the liquid, close to the liquidest temperature, if there's the right chemical interaction between the species and the right relative sizes and the right relative compositions, then they may form. Whether they form in the gaseous phase, I would think not, but.
And let me ask, on the first introductory slide, where's the gas-liquid transition?
Where is it? It was off the chart, way off to the left, much higher temperature.
Just a stupid question, what is the liquidest temperature? Is that melting or?
There's a liquidest temperature and a solidest temperature. The liquidest is where the temperature above which everything is liquid. The melting temperature is if you're heating from the solid state, and it's where you first start to get melting. And so in metal alloys, there's usually a difference between those two.
So these are
yeah. Okay. Substance, yeah, it's only exactly at a eutectic point where the melting temperature and the liquidus are the same. Okay, so first consequence is this: there are four distinct atomic species and sites. So I've already talked about this solute that's at the center of the cluster. This is sort of like the conductor who's organizing things and says, okay. You know, N of you solvent guys, you're my buddies, you hang out with me. And so this alpha solute is it's the atomic species and it's the site at the center of the cluster. And then in the first shell, those are all what I'll call solvent sites, and they're typically occupied by solvent atoms, but not always. So you have those two sites and those two species. But now you can also imagine that there's another site that would be at the center of an octahedron of these clusters. I call that a beta site. And there's also a gamma site that would be at the center of a tetrahedron of these clusters. And the size of atom that you could fit in these positions, we haven't defined yet, but you might imagine, we've done some rough calculations, that it would be somewhat less than the size of these alpha solutes. But nevertheless, you can imagine that there might be four different sites and four different species. And for reasons that I won't go into great detail here, we've just taken the initial assumption that the alpha is always the biggest, and then the beta is the next biggest and the gamma is the smallest, and that's just based on some notional ideas about the size of the octahedral interstice versus the tetrahedral interstice. And there are some observations that suggest that this is not a bad first start, but it's probably not always correct. Let's see.
In general, there is room for more stuff in those.
Yes.
Size.
Yes.
So you're going to fill those up next door.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Ah, okay, right. Okay, the next point is
not to scale.
It's not to scale, and I've kept them apart just so you can see them.
Much less space.
Much less space. So actually, so I've got if you stop by my office, I've got about 24 of these, and we can pack them together, and you can look and get some idea.
But isn't that clear what you call a your elementary cluster?
It gets to be a little confusing. It gets to be, especially if you start to get a high concentration of solute. I'll show you some pictures in a minute. So the next point is that in this sort of arrangement, the solute atoms occupy sites that are more or less ordered. So if we put these clusters at the sites of sort of like an FCC lattice, then you would expect the solute at the center to be more or less at the points of an FCC lattice. And this provides a simple visual physical explanation for medium range order of the solute species, but not the solvent species. And by the way, that matches exactly what the experimental data had shown for the last 20 years. So for example, and I'll show you the results in nickel-boron, the boron-boron was found to be ordered, but not the nickel-nickel. So this provides a very simple explanation, and I'll show some quantitative validation of that in a little bit.
This also depends on whether your clusters are sharing faces.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to make a big point of this right here. They're not ordered sites. If they were ordered sites, this would not be an amorphous structure. But they're sort of ordered, and the reason they're sort of ordered is for the reason that you just said, and that is that the clusters are not spheres, and they have a variable separation that depends on whether they share vertices or faces or something in between. And I want to make a big point of this because a lot of my colleagues have had a big issue with this, and so I'll just...
But just on that, you'd expect them then to become more ordered for more extreme size ratios, where you have a large number in your solvent shell.
Because well, so it depends. If you have a radius ratio greater than one, what you've said is true.
Whichever way around it is. But one of the things that you have is you've got a certain number of these small atoms packed around a big one.
Yeah.
And the bigger that number, the more spherical that object.
Well, so it could be small atoms packed around a big one or big ones packed around a small one. If it's small packed around a big, what you said is correct.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. So here are a few quotes. Napoleon Bonaparte, 99% loyalty is 100% disloyalty. So if you replace order and disorder, that's sort of what I'm thinking about. A little bit more in the pop culture. He's not dead. I said he's mostly dead. Big difference.
Is he a
realtor? Unfortunately, no. But I don't know if you've seen the movie. This was played by Billy Crystal in The Princess Bride. And then this is from Captain Barbosa. The pirate's code is more what you'd call guidelines than actual rules. Welcome aboard the Black Pearl, Missy. So that's sort of the way that we're thinking about this. And we would argue that as a result of this, beyond two or three or four cluster diameters, you start to lose this identifiable order. And that's sort of consistent with diffraction data as well. And then the final consequence is, as soon as you start to talk about preferred atom positions and sites, you introduce the possibility of defects, which is rather heretical when you think about glasses as a random structure. If it's random, then you can't have a defect because nothing's regular, nothing's expected. But as soon as you say that I expect on the large part that solvents will surround a solute, then you can have a defect by having either not enough solvent there to fill up that shell, or if you put a solute instead of a solvent, you can start to talk about different sorts of defects. And I'm going to start to go through this a little bit more quickly. But here are some pictures of some of the sorts of defects. This is a structure a couple of people have mentioned that you might expect specific compositions and specific size ratios. So this would be like a happy glass where you have three different types of solutes, an alpha that's a blue sphere, you can't see it in the center here, a beta that's a purple here that's a little bit different size, a gamma that's even smaller yet. And by the way, this is exactly the structure of the vitrioli glasses, zirconium, aluminum, copper, nickel, beryllium. So this would be the beryllium, this would be the copper, nickel, this would be the titanium or aluminum or niobium and zirconium. So this is exactly what that structure would look like. But you could have a defective structure where you don't have any solutes in these beta and gamma sites. So it would look like this. This would be a binary glass, and you have a composition of solute large enough to fill the center of all these clusters, but that's it. Or you could have the same binary glass with a higher composition, and so now you start to put these alpha atoms on the beta sites. So now we have anti-site defects, and so on. So there are lots and lots of ways you can do this. I'll probably show some more pictures, but those are some of the defects. One important defect that I want to point out is what I call an alpha-omega defect. This is where we put a solute on a solvent site. The reason this is important, and we can look for this experimentally, is as follows. If the alpha concentration is just low enough, or just high enough to make these clusters that form the structural scaffold, you never get alpha-alpha contact. If I put in more solute, they'll start to fill these beta sites. And these, some people would call this, by the way, a glue atom. Dong in China has used that sort of nomenclature. So now you have, here you can see the clusters don't overlap. Here you can identify clusters that do overlap, but you still don't have alpha-alpha contact. It's only when you continue to increase the solute concentration further and start to put the solutes on the solvent sites that you now start to get this. And I'll show you some experimental data a little bit later on that shows exactly that transition. Okay, so that's the main idea in the formation of this structural model. We call it the efficient cluster packing model. Three more rules, but much simpler. First of all, the clusters don't overlap, so I've already talked about that. We can identify, we can probe this experimentally. If they did overlap, you would get densities that are much higher, and you would get partial coordination numbers that are different and concentrations that are different, and so we've looked at that, and the data clearly support this idea that the structure-forming clusters don't overlap. When we continue to add more solutes, eventually we can form overlapping clusters, but the important distinction is that when I put an alpha at this alpha site, I create some number of solvent sites. After I fill all the alpha sites, I don't create any more sites. I can fill this site, but when I fill this site, I'm not creating any more solvent sites. Third rule is that there's no orientational order between the different clusters. If there was, we'd have a crystal, and there are lots of crystals. For example, if these are icosahedron, the MOAL12 structure, tungsten AL12 structure, this is a well-known crystal structure, that's what you would get. Or you would also get this icosahedral glass model that Stevens and others have proposed. So this is the third rule. And the fourth...
Sorry, then you say these are more like plastic crystals, right? So where you have spatial order but orientational disorder?
Okay, yes. I don't understand plastic crystals. Well, I've read that only a little bit, but what you've said is correct.
That's what I learned.
Yeah. Okay, so from what we both understand, I would say yes.
I see. So they're not fully glassy because they have some translational long-range order.
Not long range.
No, just going off. This picture all fades out of...
After a few cluster diameters.
...units of the big structure.
Yep. No translational order.
It's not clear from what you said why it fades out like that.
Well, he's sort of saying it in terms of the fact that the cluster's not quite spherical, and so they can actually lock in different orientations to give you variable...
Yeah, let me try it like this. I don't know if you're familiar with the bubble wrap model work that had been done. If you have all the same size bubbles, you get a crystalline array. If you put in a second type of bubble with a slightly different size, you still get a crystalline array, but it becomes strained. But once the size in the bubbles becomes big enough, a large enough different, then you start to form a disordered structure. And what you're really doing is you start to introduce differences in the inter-bubble separations. And you get exactly that in the clusters. You get a variability, but in a different way. You get it now just because they're knobby, and they can either be, you know, sharing a vertex, you know, where they're far apart, or they can be sharing faces where they're closer together. And that produces internal strains that eventually will break down identifiable long-range translation or order of the crystals. Okay, and then the final rule is that not only do these alpha solutes have these special radius ratios that enable efficient atomic packing, but the solutes that fill the beta and gamma sites also will have these same sorts of radius ratios. Okay, so that's it. Just a couple of quick conventions on how we view the glasses now from a topological perspective. We always list the alloy compositions with omega first, the solvent first, followed by the alpha solute, beta solute, and gamma solute. It actually gives you a way of organizing lots and lots of otherwise confusing data. So for example, when you look at this glass here with six different elements in it, we find that there are actually only four different atom sizes. And so we sort of lump the aluminum and titanium together, and we would say that topologically, they're the same in the sense that they occupy the same sites in the structure. Copper and nickel have the same size. Chemically, they're different, and that's important. But topologically, they share the same site. And so when you start to look at it like this, now it gives you a way to organize an otherwise rather confusing array of glasses that have been made and so on.
Can I ask another terminology question? What's the solvent? Is that always the most common species? Or
yes. After we do this lumping by size, the solvent is the one that has the highest concentration. And it's a good question because sometimes the solvent concentration is distressingly small, 40%, and you've got a solvent, for example. If you've got enough species, that's possible. The other thing that's important is that a lot of people, for example, will say, we made a zirconium glass, but it's got lots of titanium and niobium in it, and if you add the titanium and niobium concentrations together, you find there's actually more of that than there is zirconium. So from a topological perspective, it gives you a different result than you might imagine otherwise.
You have the size and you have the concentration, so...
Still haven't talked about concentrations, but I'll get there.
No, just in terms of computing, so you're ordering, you said you're ordering by the size, and the largest...
Is the alpha.
The most
concentrated, the highest concentration is called the solvent.
And you order the solutes by size.
And we order the solutes by size.
They're about half bigger than one, I guess.
Yeah, right. Yep. Okay, and I'll use a nomenclature where I describe the glass like this, so I give it by the coordination numbers of the alpha, beta, and gamma. So for example, the vitriol glasses would be a 12-10-9. Because the aluminum has a radius ratio of about 0.9, so you can have 12 zirconiums around it. This has a radius ratio of about 0.8 relative to that, so you can fit 10 zirconiums around it, and so on. Calcium, magnesium, zinc, copper, 10-9-8 glasses, and so on. So just a shorthand notation. So now let's talk a little bit about the complexity. So this I've shown you before. This I would call a 12-10-9 glass. These are icosahedron. These have a size so that you can fit 10 of the solvents around it and so on. This would be a different glass. This would be a 17-12-10. So now the biggest solute is actually bigger than the solvent. And so on. You can imagine there are lots of different ways you can do this. And in fact, we've counted 276 different structural topologies. There are these binaries possible, lots of ternaries, dot, dot, dots, and even more quaternaries. By the way, we've looked at some hundreds of complex glasses, and we haven't found any yet that have more than four different atom sizes. So it's not a proof, but it's consistent with this idea that there are four atomic sites, and there seems to be some sort of preference. And the next slide, I'll get to the compositions. So we're getting close. So if you want to specify the structure, then you have this rather complicated and unwieldy sort of approach. We have what we call site occupancies. I'll call this an Sij. This is the number of I atoms on J sites per alpha site. And we normalize by the alpha site because that gives us an important simplification. So there's always one alpha site per alpha site. There's one beta site per alpha site. There are two gammas. You just get that from FCC symmetry. And the number of omega sites depends on the relative size between the alpha and the omega. So that's some function there. So this is pretty unwieldy. If you wanted to find the structure of a complex glass, you somehow have to assign all of these. There's no way that we've gotten to that point yet. But we have done this for binary glasses. It becomes quite a bit simpler because you lose half of these values. And I'm just skipping over some stuff, but comparing with experimental data, we find that the omega atoms only go on omega sites. They never go on any of the alpha sites, so these terms are all zero. So all we have to do is sort of figure out what these terms are, and we can actually determine what this value is here, the total sum of the S alpha J's. And then what we do once we determine that is we fill the alpha sites first, then the beta sites, then the gamma sites, and if we still have solute left over, we put it on the omega sites. And this seems to work very well. As I mentioned, we've just done this assessment of binary glasses, and we've looked at hundreds, well, 692 binary glasses, and this seems to do a pretty good job for most of the experimental data that we've looked at there. So this just gives you a visual picture. If S bar alpha equals 1, there's one alpha atom per alpha site, so you just form enough clusters to form the structural scaffold. If S bar alpha is 2, there are 2 alpha atoms per alpha site, so one of those go on all the alpha sites, and then you have enough to fill all the beta sites. If S bar alpha is 4, you can fill all the alpha, beta, and gamma sites with alpha. And if S bar alpha is greater than 4, then you start to substitute these as well. And of course, S bar alpha can be a real number. It doesn't have to be an integer. So what we were led to think is that, aha, there must be specific compositions. Something must be special when you just fill all the alpha sites or all the alpha and beta sites. And generally that occurs sometimes, but not always. And we think we understand a little bit better what controls that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Okay, so now we're to compositions. And it's really pretty simple in the binary sense. So let's say we have a solute with a radius ratio around 0.710. So that represents these metal-metalloid glasses and others as well. So we would propose that the coordination number is about 9. You could have about 9 solvent atoms in the first shell. This is widely validated experimentally, where people measure the coordination numbers around the boron or the silicon or the cobalt or whatever. And just to look at the compositions now, if you fill all the alpha sites, you have one alpha atom per alpha site, and you have 10 different sites. You've got 9 solvent sites in the alpha site, so the composition would be 10%. If you fill all the alpha and beta sites, you would get a composition of 18%. Keep in mind that most of these glasses, most of with this radius ratio, are most stable at about 18 to 20%, and this matches that quite nicely. You fill all the alpha, beta, and gamma sites at a composition of 31%, and if you have more than 31%, you actually start to form some of these defects. If you look at glasses with different radius ratio, 0.902, coordination number is 12, go through the numbers here and you can see you fill all the alpha sites at a slightly less composition, you fill all the alpha, beta, and gamma sites at a slightly lower composition, and as this radius ratio continues to increase, these numbers change as well. And so we can, you know, we can compare then what you see experimentally. I'll do that on the next chart, but this just gives you a visual of what's happening, and I'm using zirconium copper as a proxy binary system. So zirconium, you start to add copper, the copper is smaller than zirconium, so you start to fill these alpha sites, then you fill the beta sites, and so on. Things get sort of confused in here, and then if you start from over here, this would be basically a copper-based alloy with zirconium as the solute. Somewhere in between, you have to say which is the solute and which is the solvent. It becomes not very clear. We've defined what we call the isostructural composition, and you'll notice it's not at 50%. If the atom sizes were both the same, it would be exactly at 50%. But since the atom sizes are different, it's shifted slightly. What we find is that in the binary systems, the bulk metallic glasses are almost always near this isostructural composition. And some terms that I'll use a solute-lean glass, which means we don't have enough solute to fill all the alpha, beta, and gamma sites. And solute-rich glasses, where we have more than enough solute to fill the alpha, beta, and gamma sites, so we start to form some of these alpha-omega defects as well. So that's just sort of a pictorial ram of how we'll use this nomenclature. This is the grand topology plot for all the binary glasses that we've been able to find by looking through publications in the literature. Each one of these data points is a specific atom pair, and then this error bar is the range in compositions over which that pair of atoms can form a metallic glass by quenching from the liquid. So no mechanical alloying, no vapor deposition, but all quenching. And so a couple of things. This line right here is what we would predict is the minimum solute concentration. This is where you have just enough solute to fill all the alpha sites. You can see that it's a function of radius ratio. And for all of these glasses, we see pretty good agreement. Out of 692 alloys, only one of them goes below that. If, by the way, we said that the alpha clusters overlapped in the first shell, you would predict this is the minimum concentration. You can see that that doesn't match the experiment very well. So this is one of the observations we use to support the idea that the alpha clusters don't overlap. This right here is the boundary between solute-lean glasses, where you don't have enough solute to fill all the solute sites, and solute-rich glasses where you now start to form these alpha omega defects. This is the isostructural composition, so if the radius ratio is 0.1, it's right at 50%, and it goes like that. And then these purple things are binary bulk metallic glasses, and palladium silicon is the only exception. All of the others are solute-rich. And so that gives some indication on preferred compositions. And in this, I don't have a view graph to describe it, but so I'll just mention it in words right now. In this paper, we argue that the reason this happens is there's an enthalpic term that stabilizes these. When you start to make these anti-site defects, you form even more unlike atom bonds. And there's also an entropic term as well, because now you start to introduce the possibility of disorder in these atomic clusters. And so both of those tend to stabilize these structures relative to the solute-lean ones. Okay, I'm going to skip over this. The basic idea, I went through this chart on binary glasses, how you can assign solutes to different structural sites based on the composition. And the main point with this is we can't do that for ternaries yet. We don't know enough, and there's some ambiguity. So I'll just finish up with a few of the quantitative comparisons between predictions from this simple structural model and experimental data, and especially I'll focus on the partial coordination numbers and medium range order. So partial coordination numbers, without going into any detail, we've come up with these rather simple equations for the partial coordination numbers as a function of these Sij terms. So in a binary glass, if we know the composition and the relative size, then we can identify these Sij values, and then that gives us a prediction on partial coordination numbers. This is for alpha-alpha, alpha-omega, and then omega-omega and omega-alpha. And so if we look at the comparison between prediction and experiment, the experiment are from diffraction data from different people. I don't have the actual citations listed here, but they're in this paper. And you can see basically the agreement's pretty good. In most cases, we're within experimental error, which is typically plus or minus 10%, except when these numbers are small, and then the error is probably a larger percentage. And so, like I said, there are a few where we don't match that well. Here's another one. But by and large, we're able to predict within experimental error, which is it's a little surprising. But now, with respect to the medium range order, it's a very simple idea, basically. If you're just looking at the order of the solutes at the center of the cluster, then if you look at the solute-solute partial pair distribution function and compare that to different structure factors, you can identify what is the most likely organization of the clusters. And the only thing you have to do is you have to multiply this, for example, the structure factor of FCC or simple cubic or something by some length factor that represents the separation between clusters. And so so we do this simple calculation just using hard spheres. So for example, this might be the 100 direction. You have an alpha site, you have a beta site right in the middle, and another alpha site. And you actually end up with three equations here. This cluster and this cluster share vertices with this beta. So this lambda naught, this cluster unit cell length, is just the sum of the radii. If this beta shares an edge with these clusters, the adjoining clusters, then you get this equation here, which is a little bit smaller. And if they share faces, which I can't show in two dimensions, you get this equation here, which is even a little bit smaller. So for example, for this 100 calculation, you get three different numbers. And we've actually done it for the 110 and the 111. So you get these nine different values. And what we do is we only look at the face sharing, because that's the most efficient way to pack the clusters. And then we take the largest number. And the reason we take the largest number is then that means there's a tensile strain along the other directions, which is easy enough to accommodate by maybe edge sharing or vertex sharing in those other directions. But if, for example, if we took the smallest one, then you would have very large compressive strains in the other directions, and since the repulsive potential is much higher, that wouldn't make much sense. So very simple, we just did, it's just Hartzfeher phase sharing, and we took the biggest one, and so that's our scaling parameter. And then we multiply, I'm gonna skip over this. We multiply that times FCC, or simple cubic structure factor, HCP structure factor, BCC structure factor, FCC. The solid line is experimental data for the boron-boron separation in nickel-boron that's from Lamparter. Citation's given there. And so you can see that, okay, you get some agreement for the simple cubic structure factor. You don't capture the splitting of this first peak, but you do get the first peak. You get splitting of this peak, but you get the intensities wrong. But you know, some agreement. If you look at the HCP structure factor, you actually don't get very good agreement at all. HCP's got lots and lots of peaks. BCC, you basically miss things altogether. FCC cluster packing, you actually get pretty good agreement. You get splitting of the first peak, you get the intensities right. Splitting of the second peak, you get the intensities wrong, relative intensities, and you get this peak. But then beyond that, things start to fall apart. And this supports our claim earlier that beyond 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 solute distances, the fifth nearest solute-solute separation, you start to lose this identifiable order. So this is where we've taken nickel-boron and looked at different crystalline structure factors. We also looked at the dense random structure factor, which we've gotten from the modeling work by Bennett and Finney. Doesn't match badly, but not as good as the FCC. We've looked at two different icosahedral packings, Bergman packing and McKay packing. McKay packing is actually not very bad. You don't get this split peak quite as well, and you get the wrong intensities here, but otherwise it looks pretty good. But still, the FCC packing seems to be, rather subjectively, the best of all the different structure factors that we've looked at. So this sort of supports the comment that I made before, that the FCC cluster organization seems to be the best overall fit. So that's we use that looking at just one system, the nickel-boron system, to determine whether FCC or BCC is the best. But we've looked at lots of other systems as well, zirconium-nickel, niobium-nickel, I'm sorry, niobium-nickel, nickel-niobium. And again, experimental data taken from others in the literature, and it's only for the solute-solute partial distribution function, and then this is what we predict. So again, we get a pretty good agreement. The other thing I want to mention is that the structure for this, it's about 19% boron. That's just enough for boron in all the alpha and beta sites. So we don't expect any boron-boron contact. And in fact, the people who have published the diffraction data make a big point of that, no boron-boron contact. So you don't really see a peak where you would expect one for boron-boron contact. It would be about 170 picometers. However, these other glasses all have high enough solute concentrations so that these are what we would call solute-rich glasses. You would expect solute-solute contact, and in fact, in every one of those, you see a peak at the solute-solute position. So this would be nickel-nickel, this would be nickel-nickel, and this is niobium-niobium. And we actually even get the intensities right 2 out of 3 times. So this is an experimental way of looking to see if you do get these specific types of anti-site defects that I've mentioned before. Density is a bit problematic. You know, it's my feeling that, well, the agreement's not good. It's not really bad. But we have errors of, let's say, plus or minus 30% in density, predicted density. Again, we use this lambda naught that I mentioned before, the same one that we use for the medium range order. However, keep in mind that the density depends on this lambda naught to the third power. So if we deconvolve this into an error in lambda, we're getting an error in that lambda scaling factor of about 10%. This was work that was done some years ago when we found some, well, we had made some simplifications, and if we correct those simplifications, we actually get much better agreement. Haven't published that work yet, but hopefully in the next 6 months we'll write that down. So we actually get density errors that are plus or minus 10% if we correct that. So we can get reasonable agreement with the density. So that's sort of the main story. I've got just a couple more things that I want to show. I think of this as a relatively simple model. Other people tell me I'm wrong. It's not that simple. And it actually, there's even more complexity if you look kind of carefully. So these are a number of additional topics that we're working on now. We've already mentioned this before. Which solute is really the alpha solute? We're assuming it's the biggest one, but we're starting to see some data that suggests that that's not always true. How big are the beta sites and the gamma sites relative to the alpha? We're still working on that. I just mentioned we're working to refine prediction of density and partial coordination number. A lot of work on defects, both constitutional and thermal defects I haven't mentioned, and so on. So just one idea that I want to show you Again, Sri, this gets to your question about, you know, preferred compositions. Lots and lots of different topologies, and it's a good question to ask. Do all of them have the same stability, or are some more stable than others? We've already talked about this in terms of binary glasses. It seems that there are some that are not preferred, and we really don't know why. But some seem to be strongly preferred, coordination number of 9, 10, 12, 15, 17. And I want to introduce this one last idea, what we call an inverse relationship that, well, okay, to me, it's, I still don't understand it. It seems to be a serendipity, and maybe someone has some more insight into this. But we identify what we call inverse glasses. So I showed these pictograms before. You can go from an A solute, B solvent, and then you actually end up the other way around. And in between, you can sort of call these inverse glasses. This might have a radius ratio of R. And then this would have a radius ratio of 1 over R. So this is solute divided by solvent. This would be solvent divided by solute. And if the radius ratio here is one of these special radius ratios that allows efficient atomic packing in the first shell, then you might think this might be a good glass. But what if 1 over R also matched a value? Would you even expect that? I would not, but in fact it happens. And the best case is for this radius ratio of 0.799, where you get a coordination number of 10. Just we'll just say that that radius ratio is 0.8. If you take 1 over 0.8, you get 1.25. And that's almost exactly the radius ratio that you need for coordination number of 17. The actual value here is 1.248. Within, you know, to a small number in the third decimal place, they're the same. So you can form these inverse glasses where, for example, these are some of them, zirconium nickel, zirconium copper, hafnium nickel, nickel hafnium. So that you get this extended range of glass formability. In some regions, this, for example, would be a zirconium-based glass with nickel. This would be a nickel-based glass with zirconium. Zirconium with copper, copper with zirconium. And it's because we would propose, because there's such a small difference between the inverse radius ratio here and here. I can't think of any reason why it has to be that way, but in this case it is. The other case where it's almost as good is the 0.902 for coordination number of 12. If you take 1 over 0.902, you get 1.117. No, I'm sorry, 1.11 something. Radius ratio for 15 is 1.116, so they almost match. And again, you have glasses that form extended ranges of compositions that span this isostructural composition. And then that's it. There are no other radius ratios that match as well across the isostructural composition. Radius ratio for 0.9, you can see there's a big gap that almost falls in between the radius ratio here for 19 and 20. Radius ratio for 8 here, you almost matches with 23, but there are no glasses that have this radius ratio, so this doesn't have a friend on the other side. So there seems to be this sort of serendipitous relationship where the inverse radius ratio allows efficient atomic packing on both sides, and that seems to match with the most common glasses that have a radius ratio of coordination number of 10 or 17 or 12 or 15. So can't say that we really understand that, but that's the way it is. This quote doesn't fit into the talk at all, but this, I got this, honest to goodness, I got this as a comment from one of the papers we submitted. So, and since this is a physics community, I thought I'd throw that in there. I'm not sure what to do with that. So there's still lots of big issues. We need to refine these basic structural concepts to deal more quantitatively with these solute-rich structures. Things become quite confusing when you start to get a large number of solutes on the solvent sites. And the most stable glasses, by the way, have between a quarter and a third of the solvent sites occupied by solutes. And so we're trying to understand that and describe that, and then come up with good quantitative descriptions of partial coordination numbers and density and so on. We also feel that the chemical contributions are important. This actually is a two-year hiatus that we've taken and just recently finished. It's our view that there are three important things you have to understand, and you have to understand all three to understand metallic glasses. One is topology, and that's all I've talked about so far. One is kinetics, a lot of good work in kinetics. And the third is chemistry. There are three different bond energies you can imagine, and we think the relative magnitude of the AA, AB, and BB bond energies are important. But to our way of thinking, we haven't been able to find any good way to quantify those, so we've spent 2 years resolving that issue, and we've come up with a simple approach that's based on classical thermodynamics. And so we're now working, now that we've developed a way to define the chemical bond energies, we're now looking at how those map back into these topologies. And then if we take these two things together, we think that we can also start to address things like understanding the strength and fragility of supercooled liquids in metallic glasses. So lots of hard work still in front of us, but we have made some important progress. Some of these points I haven't really made. But this rather simple structural model gives a simple physical picture that's not only consistent visually with respect to short-range order and medium-range order, but also quantitatively. And it gives these sort of subjective agreement with other observations. For example, basically you never see more than four different atomic sizes, even though you might have
something about that. I mean, there are several groups that do experiments on colloids to investigate properties of metallic alloys. So there you could probably create the systems that you might be. Yeah. Is there anything that
So the people in this room know a heck of a lot more about colloids than I do, but my view is that most of the work doesn't use attractive potentials. And if you don't have attractive potentials, you won't expect to match this. There is some work that in the colloids that has started to do that, and we're just now actually hiring a postdoc who just, well, actually he hasn't defended yet, but he's supposed to defend next month, and then he's going to start a postdoc with us, and that's exactly what he's going to do. We're going to tailor the...
So you would need to A, B, B, and A, B.
Exactly. Yeah, and he assures me that by changing the chemical properties of the solution, they can get different attractive potentials that are on the order of KT, and they can vary the relative attractions by functionalizing the different surfaces of the different colloids. So we intend to sort of look at that starting this fall.
Although everything you said today didn't really use the fact that you have attraction.
Yes, it does.
You talked about the packing.
Well, but if you don't have attraction, then you don't have a preference for A only around a B. So I made this point right up front on my first track. If you don't have the attractive potential, you won't get the same answer, period. So again, there's lots and lots of good work that's done, but you have to make sure that it matches these criteria if you want to match metallic glass.
So but the key thing really is that you have an AB attraction.
That's more negative than AA or BB.
No AA and no B. So AA and BB just are steric. And AB, AA and BB stack, and AB is attractive. That would be good enough.
I think maybe so.
For most of what you said.
I think maybe so. I think the relative magnitude between AA and BB may ultimately be important, but at the next level of detail. So I think at the first level of detail, what you said is probably correct. So a couple of points that I haven't made through the talk. This gives us a way to organize. We look at structures, and actually these ideas now, I don't think it's too much to claim, have proved quite useful in some very, very good atomic simulation work that's been done in the last few years. Evan Ma at Johns Hopkins in particular, and Howard Chang, one of his postdocs, have done some really, really good work. But they use these ideas to look at their simulations after they relax the structure. And now you can start to see things once you know, once you organize your way of looking. So it's proved helpful in computations as well. And in an experimental sense as well, you know, listen, one of the issues with metallic glasses is you find new metallic glasses by extensive trial and error. Inouye's claim, and I've heard many other professors say the same, that a good graduate student can turn out 1,000 alloys a year. And maybe that's true, but you burn up a lot of good graduate students. And so the idea is, if we have some more fundamental understanding, that perhaps we can improve that process. And in fact, since we've started to develop these ideas, there are a number of new bulk metallic glass systems, and in fact, entire families based on calcium that have come directly from these ideas. We made, that must have been like 5 or 6 years ago, we made 16 calcium alloys using these ideas. And 12 of the 16 we made were bulk glasses the first time. So, the iron-based glasses were actually made by another group who used some of our ideas. This is from the University of Virginia group. So these ideas do seem to help reduce the degree of trial and error in these sort of systems. So that's it. Appreciate your attention, and can answer any other questions if there's time.
Thank you.
So at the beginning you talk about structure determining properties, and then you talk a little bit about structure. But one of the things that seems quite nice about what you described here is that you can start to see some way in which these different packings of these pseudospheres would have different material properties, no?
Yes.
You can at least begin to think about that.
Yep, so a couple of things, and I'm not prepared to talk about it now because we haven't gone through the calculations in detail, but one thing, well, let me see, so properties. Well, it depends on which...
Even things like the modulus and so on. So, you know, for instance, if you end up with a simple cubic lattice of things that have essentially central forces, then actually you don't have a modulus. And so you might expect that to be rather soft compared to some of the other structures where you're filling in the interstices, for instance.
Yep.
So, I mean, the very, you know, quite qualitative comments like that, which you might already be able to detect some sign of in your
data. Yeah, and there's been a lot of work in terms of looking at deformation and shear bands where people argue that you get these cluster shearing over each other and not... and so those arguments, Lindsay Greer has used some of those comments to argue for the measured thickness of shear bands.
I see.
Well, is there an effort to correlate with mechanical properties and to see where...
Well, so mechanical properties, we're still a long way off from that. Places where we think we can make a contribution, for example, the initiation of deformation, we believe we can identify structural features within this construct that could be what I would call a proto-STZ. So it's the place where you would expect shear to occur first when you apply an applied shear stress. And they would be regions where you might locally disrupt the percolation of these strong AB bonds. In that region, two things will happen. One, you'll have a locally low modulus, and you'll also have locally higher free volume because it's these ABs next to each other that orchestrate and enforce efficient local atomic packing. And if you just have, if you have a volume where you're mostly all A or mostly all B, then you don't have anything to orchestrate that, and you'll have a higher free volume. And we've done some rough calculations looking at constitutional defects and at thermal defects, and we find that the sizes that we would propose based on these structural concepts are on the order of 20 to 80 atoms, which is roughly consistent with what people propose based on experiment and models for STZs. We've also made some predictions based on the concentration of thermal defects based on relative sizes and these chemical bond strengths that we've gotten. And they seem to scale very, very well, not only with strength, but also with glass forming ability. So we do think that there are some paths there. We have to start very, very slowly because some of these are very, very complex structure properties relationships, and we want to start with the very simplest things that we think we can understand. But I think in the next couple of years, I think there are some good things that we could do in that area.
Yeah, you'd think that the glasses where the beta and gamma sides are empty, and if the AB bonds are strong, they should almost play like points plus colloid.
Yes.
Because you just think of the clusters as like effective colloid.
Yep. Another thing that we can do, by the way, is we can compare...
The institutional ones will kind of lock the thing up.
Yeah.
Could change the...
Yeah, again, the term that's most commonly used is called glue atoms.
Yeah.
And that's...
Okay, so people think in those terms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think your model could be related to this structure heterogeneity widely found in the mechanical classes. And the structure heterogeneity it's been found related with other properties, for example, mechanical properties, for example, STZ and boson peak, something like that. So I think the efficient packing of the cluster is maybe not necessary for, in one case, for the forming and dark container classes. It also depends on some other factors, dynamic or For example, their processing.
Yeah.
So, but the UG model could be explained with their inhomogeneity of this. For example, in the BMG, some part is very soft, some part is hard. It's where you do some negation of the modulus, elastic modulus, mechanical properties and fluid.
Yeah. So first of all, I agree completely with everything you said. Again, there are three things you have to understand glass stability and glass forming ability. Topology is only one of them, and it's not enough. You'd have to understand the kinetics and you'd have to understand the chemistry. And so there are some obvious areas where, for example, I must have taken the chart out, but if you look at zirconium, aluminum, copper, nickel,
yes,
the wide stability range of metallic glasses, there are specific compositions, especially with aluminum, nickel, and copper, that have the best glass forming ability. And let me think, so it's zirconium, 7.5 aluminum, and then a total of 27.5 nickel plus copper. Mm-hmm. So from a topological perspective, that defines the topology. But now if you change the relative amount of copper and nickel, it doesn't change the topology any, since copper and nickel have the same atomic size. But it does change the chemistry, and it dramatically changes the glass forming ability. So that has to be something else, something else that's really important in the glass forming ability that the topological model is not capturing. So that's perhaps a chemical effect, and we need to understand that. Now in terms of the structural heterogeneity, again, I think you're right. If you look at standard diffraction analysis, there are two different ways of analyzing the data. There's the Bacci-Thornton, and I forget what the other one is. But one gives you composition fluctuations. The other gives you density fluctuations. And they're present. I'll have to go back and read the literature to see what sort of length scale those fluctuations occur over. But it's my view that they may scale with the same sorts of composition and density fluctuations that we would predict here. We haven't made that comparison. Another thing, too, that I think is an important manifestation of the relative magnitude of AA, AB, and BB bonds is that that can influence the degree to which the solute distribution is ordered or more or less ordered. So I said that it's sort of like FCC packing. It could be really close, or for some binary systems and other systems, it might not be nearly so close based on the relative magnitude of those chemical interactions. And so if you have one binary system that has a more ordered cluster arrangement and another one with a less ordered cluster arrangement, you would expect some very different compositional fluctuations. And I think one of the manifestations would be the nucleation events. I think you're familiar with the work that Perepesco and others have done on the nucleation of amorphous aluminum alloys, where you get an amazingly high number density of crystal nuclei, 10 to the 21st, 10 to the 22nd nuclei per cubic meter, which is 10 to the 6th higher than you normally get. And we feel that that may be due to these sorts of compositional fluctuations, and we've made some arguments based on these sorts of concepts that are qualitative right now, but may help explain those sorts of things as well.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, it reminds a little bit of the old droplet models you had in nuclear physics.
So you're talking about gas condensation from the gas?
Okay, so in nuclear physics, I mean, you know this problem.
Nuclear physics.
Neutrons and protons and these droplet models. It's also geometric effects, and there's certainly two species should better pair of.
So actually, it doesn't remind me of that because my background in nuclear physics.
Exactly.
But I will say, if I see people are ready to go, but I will mention just one other thing. There's a rather large community in material science called the magic number.
Yeah.
And they see the same sort of thing. They nucleate clusters from the gas phase, and they find that these clusters are unusually stable.
And that's a lot closer.
It's a lot closer. And so we're actually collaborating with them because they're arguing that, hey, if we can make a halide-like cluster, we can make a rare earth metal-like cluster, and maybe we can make super materials by combining these clusters. And my argument is, we already do that. That's what metallic glasses are. We take different clusters of different characters and put them together. So we're working together with a fellow named Shiv Khanna at Virginia Commonwealth, who does a lot of ab initio.
Hybrid glasses, where those clusters were covalently bonded, some kind of strange, thing, and then you make a glass by mixing those things together in some cunning way. So there's, you're doing anything.
Okay.
Yeah, it's probably long enough for session today, but you can quote another movie and say, I'll be back.
I'll be back. Okay.